Welcome to Dispatches, a shorter podcast from the old front line and me, military historian Paul Reed. In this episode of Dispatches, we'll look at the Dead Man's Penny, the bronze memorial plaque that was produced to commemorate the fallen of the Great War, and we'll ask how it connects us to the battlefields of that conflict. A century ago, the houses where the families of fallen men and women who had died in the Great War while serving with British and Commonwealth forces lived were receiving packages from organisations like the War Office or the Admiralty, sending them the campaign medals of their loved ones. Following a decision by the British government, these medals were also to be accompanied by the issue of a bronze memorial plaque, often called the death plaque, or the dead man's penny, or even the widow's penny, because of its design resembling an old brown penny, although much bigger. Officially, this bronze plaque, which easily filled your hand, was known as the next of kin memorial plaque. Around its edge was the legend, "He died for freedom and honour," and in the case of women, "She died for freedom and honour." A box was cast onto the plaque, and that contained the name of the casualty that bronze plaque commemorated. Civil rank, like a title, like Lord or Sir, was included within that, but no military rank. There was no military distinction at all within the naming of these plaques. Plaques to officers were identical to plaques to ordinary men. And that was, I think, an important aspect of the way those casualties of the Great War were commemorated with these plaques. Because each plaque represented a life lost in that Great War, creating a unique way of memorialising that generation who had fallen. A government committee was established in October 1916 to look at how the dead from what was then largely called the Great War would be memorialised. The committee was drawn from members of the House of Commons and the House of Lords and was chaired by Sir Reginald Braid, who was the Secretary of the War Office. They made an announcement in the national press, which got into local press as well, in early 1917. And at that time, of course, the fighting was still raging in that war on many fronts by then, not just the Western Front, fronts like Palestine and Salonika and Mesopotamia. And that announcement declared that the government intended to issue a memorial plaque to commemorate those who died. Even before the outcome of the war was known, this plan was already being put into action, into preparation. One newspaper in March 1917 stated, "The nearest relatives of fallen soldiers and sailors are to receive a bronze memorial plaque inscribed with the name, designation and deeds of the dead hero. To obtain the best symbolic design for the plaque, an artistic competition is to be invited with prizes for the best suggestions. France has been recognising her dead in this way for many months. It will be remembered that Mr. Asquith received the French memorial to mark the death of his son. This country, as usual, has been slow to move, but it is determined now to do something really worthy of the occasion." Now, it's interesting that report mentions French memorial plaques. Now, many years of collecting Great War items, I've only ever come across one of those. It's much bigger than the British and Commonwealth memorial plaque, and it's not got a box where the soldier's name is inscribed. This one has got his identity disc screwed onto the plaque. So whether that was a commercially available one and that's what they're referring to, or whether it's something else, I don't know. But there isn't a kind of general memorial plaque to French soldiers, French poilus, in the same way there is to British and Commonwealth casualties. But you can get the essence of what that report was saying, that the war's still on, but we are already looking to commemorate those who have fallen. And the report went on to say that the requirements of the plaque were that it must be approximately 18 inches square. If it was circular design, the diameter was to be 4.5 inches, and if rectangular, 5 inches by 3 3/5 inches. So quite precise kind of dimensions. And the plaque in its design also had to incorporate certain figures symbolising the British war effort and what Britain stood for, and include that legend, "He died for freedom and honour." Now, when the announcement went out, they were almost knocked over by the amount of designs submissions that came in. And in the end, they received over 800 different designs from all over Britain, from all over what was then the Empire. And it was stated in the press, even from the battlefronts. So some men who were serving in those trenches of the Great War submitted designs to commemorate their fallen comrades through this proposed plaque. All entries were submitted under a pseudonym so that the judges didn't know who the people who had submitted the designs were. And that was to create a sense of fairness, I guess. And it reflected the kind of need for a plaque. It reflected a wider Victorian penchant for bronze plaques. Because if you look at that Victorian period, and of course the parents of those who are dying in this war, they are Victorians. They've lived through that Victorian age. And in that Victorian age, just about every key event was often marked with the striking of a bronze plaque. Now, many years ago, when I was a student living on the Sussex coast, I went to see the family of a soldier who had served in the South Downs battalions of the Royal Sussex Regiment. And they were an old family in this town, had lived there for many, many generations, still in the same old house. And they had kind of a museum room in the house. And in the cabinets of that museum were these many examples of bronze Victorian medallions or plaques commemorating exhibitions, commemorating key moments in Victorian society, commemorating episodes connected to the monarch, jubilees, particular dates and events around Queen Victoria, and so many other aspects of Victorian society besides. So there was a kind of precedence for this, and I guess the roots of the idea of having a bronze memorial plaque lay in that culture of 19th century or Victorian Britain. The judging panel included staff from the National Portrait Gallery and the Victoria and Albert Museum to give that final design that would be accepted credibility, I guess, because these were the custodians of the kind of objects that they were now aiming to produce for a new generation. And then once the 800 plus designs had come in, they were sifted through, the judging panel looked at them, and then the winners were announced in March 1918, very close to that period in which the pendulum on the Western Front, for example, was swinging seemingly in the favour of the Germans when they broke through in the German offensive of March 1918 and all the subsequent battles that followed. But this committee pushed on besides. Clear, I think many British people were, that victory was still in sight, and this would be part of that victory to commemorate the fallen who had helped achieve it. The winners were announced in the same national press that had called for the designs to be submitted, and one report read, "In connection with the competition for designs for a memorial plaque to be presented to the next of kin of members of His Majesty's forces who have fallen in the war, the government committee announced that an award of £250 has been made to Paramus," and that was the nickname for Mr. E. Carter Preston of Sandon Studio Society, Liverpool, whose model is selected for reproduction, and one of £100 to Mooley, Mr. Charles Wheeler of Chelsea. Awards of £50 each have been made to other contributors, which, when I look down the list, includes Weary, that's his pseudonym, which was Sapper G.D. MacDougall from Beaconsfield in Buckinghamshire. So one of the kind of winning, not the one that was actually chosen, but one of the winning designs was actually from someone who was in the trenches. And sadly, as far as I'm aware, what those other designs look like, I've not yet found them in any contemporary newspaper reports, but it would be fascinating to see images of those if anyone listening to the podcast knows where that might be. So the winner was Edward Carter Preston. His was the winning design. He was born in Warton in 1885, and he was a renowned sculptor who had trained in Liverpool. He doesn't appear to have actually served in the Great War. He would have been, 29 when the war broke out in 1914, but I've not been able to trace him in any contemporary military records. He devoted his life to art and to sculpture and to design, and he went on to design, for example, the Distinguished Flying Cross, the DFC, as part of his work. But one of his biggest contributions was that he was later commissioned to work on the Liverpool Anglican Cathedral, doing work that would encompass 30 years of his life and career, creating figures for the cathedral building. His design was a circular plaque like a large coin with the figure of Britannia on it holding a trident and a lion, an obvious symbol of national might and empire, with dolphins symbolising naval might and power and a second lion on the plaque at the base of it tearing apart a German eagle, an obvious sign of victory over German imperialism. Information on the men to be commemorated on these plaques was then gathered from official records, and a form was sent to the next of kin asking for the details of all family members and the confirmation of the name to be engraved on the plaque. And if you look through the surviving service records that are on Ancestry, you often see this form. It's been sent to the family and they've filled it in. The name of the parents, the name of any children, brothers, sisters and so on. And it was so that the War Office could, for example, in the case of soldiers, decide who the plaque would be sent to and to get those family members to check details. If there were once official roles for the issue of these plaques, they don't appear to survive. I know many researchers over many, many years who have been fascinated with memorial plaques have tried to find those records, but to no avail. And while we know how it worked with the plaques in the army, how this worked for the Navy and the Royal Air Force, who had come into being in the latter stage of the conflict after the combining of the Royal Flying Corps and the Royal Naval Air Service, how that worked is much more of a mystery. And there seems, particularly in naval records, to be a lot of anomalies between the naming of casualties and what was put on a plaque. For example, recently a memorial plaque came up for sale that was said to be Rupert Brooke's memorial plaque. Rupert Brooke, the famous poet of the Great War, who had served in the Royal Naval Division and died after being bitten by a mosquito and died of blood poisoning en route to Gallipoli in 1915. Now, he had a middle name that is not on the plaque that is for sale, and some of the naval records include that middle name. One does not. Is it Rupert Brooke's plaque? This is kind of one of the problems, is that because there was no military rank or details placed on the plaque, when you have a name in the box that's on there and it's John Smith, unless it comes with other documents or the soldiers' medals or the servicemen's medals, then there's nothing to actually clearly identify who that plaque is to if it's a common name. It's only when you've got unique names that you can be pretty sure that the plaque is to that casualty. Initially, the plaque was meant to be only for British soldiers. It was the British government that had come up with the idea. And the design, however, once it was seen and once people saw that this was quite some object, there was a decision made to offer it to the then Empire, now Commonwealth, nations, who, of course, did want it as well. And eventually, everybody that was involved in the British and Empire Commonwealth forces of the Great War, they were all entitled, the casualties were all entitled to one of these plaques. So plaques were issued to a wide variety of soldiers that served under that flag, that bigger flag of the British and Empire forces in the Great War, including Indian soldiers and also including men who were recruited especially for war service who were not even part of the Empire. And by that I mean soldiers of the Chinese Labour Corps, for example, who were recruited in China, brought to the Western Front to act as labourers, and a couple of thousand of them died while on active service, largely from disease and influenza at the end or just after the war. Some were killed on the battlefields by shell fire, others killed in accidents clearing the battlefields up after the war, and plaques were issued to them. And I saw one once many years ago in the collection of a memorial plaque collector, and it didn't have the Chinese serviceman's name on it, it had his number, because the inclusion of Chinese script onto these plaques was deemed to be impossible. But they are out there with a number on. So if you ever see one of these memorial plaques with a number on, that's to a serviceman in the Chinese Labour Corps. Now, the Great War changed the wider British society in so many different ways, and it was a conflict in which women played a role on the battlefield or close to the battlefield on a regular basis, and over 600 women died in uniform serving as nurses or in the Queen Mary's Army Auxiliary Corps and other units associated with women who'd served in the armed forces. And they were entitled to memorial plaques as well, which is why the plaque had been designed so that inscription, "He died for freedom and honour," could also be read as "She died for freedom and honour." And like I say, over 600, the exact number is not known, but over 600 of those were issued. And all of these plaques were posted out in a stiff card brown envelope with four lifted corners, and the plaque was inside that. Then that was put in a registered envelope and posted via registered post to the address that had been supplied either via military records or by that form that had been sent out by the War Office, for example. And presumably the RAF records and the Admiralty sent out some kind of similar form to gather the details of the next of kin address for the plaques to be sent to them. And coming back to the Chinese Labour Corps for a minute, I know in the case of Chinese soldiers, both with their medals and the plaques, they couldn't be posted because of the way the postal system operated in China at that time, I believe. So the plaques and medals of men who died in the war were given before the units were disbanded and sent back to China to men who were actually serving, who I believe were either direct relatives or representatives of the family, and they were then taken back to China in that way. So in the case of plaques to men of the Chinese Labour Corps, it could be that many casualties were effectively missed out, and not every Chinese Labour Corps soldier who died was awarded a memorial plaque. Not in the same post, but about the same time, the plaque was accompanied by a memorial scroll in a tube with a letter from the King. And that is really the subject of another podcast, and the memorial scroll we will return to in a dispatches sometime in the future. So where were these plaques made, and by who? There was actually a plaque factory, and it was called the Plaque Factory, set up at Acton in London. And they were initially charged with making these bronze memorial plaques. And there's another contemporary newspaper account, an article entitled Plaque Factory, that says, "There is a little known government factory at Acton, which when other government factories are shutting down, is going full blast. Its job is to turn out the million plaques which are to be sent to the relatives of the men who have lost their loved ones in the war, and are being made from the chosen design of Mr. E. Carter Preston of Liverpool. Many people have searched for this factory in vain, for it is tucked away among buildings and is actually an old brewery. No one would associate memorial plaques with a brewery premises, but at 54 56 Church Road, Acton, and in extension buildings at the back covering half an acre in all, over 150 skilled workers are busy. Apart from the staff engaged on the technical process required for the production of the plaques, there are tabulating and recording clerks, for from the start to finish, the plaque is made on the premises." And another contemporary account records that a very high proportion of those doing the very technical work for this were women. And I think that's significant because, as we've said many times on this podcast, the women in the period of the Great War were as much victims of that conflict as the men that they'd lost. And you wonder how many women working in that factory actually ended up working on plaques that commemorated those, their own family, those they loved. In January 1920, it was reported that the plaque factory had already produced over 200,000 memorial plaques. But a few months later, in November, it was announced that it was now approaching bankruptcy after using expensive pure bronze. And those early plaques produced at the plaque factory in Acton are a much darker bronze. They're almost kind of chocolatey brown colour. And I'll put a picture on the website, both of the envelope that I've mentioned and the plaques themselves, and also an example of one of the later plaques and an earlier plaque, so you can see the difference in the colour. A local newspaper reported after this announcement about bankruptcy that Acton has been surprised by the announcement that the War Office intends to remove the War Memorial Plaque Factory to Woolwich Arsenal, as the centralising of such government work will promote the economy. The employees view the step with alarm. They number nearly 200, including many ex-servicemen. There will be little chance of them continuing the work at Woolwich, where houses are unobtainable. Local pressure is being brought to bear, and a deputation been received by the Acton Unemployment Committee. Now, despite all of that, the money had run out, and it was just proving too expensive to make these plaques with this purest bronze. So when they were moved to the Woolwich Arsenal, a new system of production, they were still very attractive looking objects, but they were a different colour and a different mix of bronze. I'm not a bronze expert, but a different mix of bronze was used. And you can see a visible difference in these plaques. And like I say, I'll put a picture on the podcast website so you can see that. And all later plaques that were made at Woolwich Arsenal were stamped with a little circle on the back with a W. And in the central crest of the W was a line through the middle of that crest for the initials WA for Woolwich Arsenal. And if you have a memorial plaque, you can turn it over and you can see if that circle with that logo is there. In total, more than 1.1 million plaques were sent out to all British and Empire casualties, although some sources do claim this could have been as many as 1.3 million, and some 450 tons of bronze were needed to make all of those plaques. And plaques continued not just to be issued in this 1920s period, a century ago, but right up until almost the outbreak of a Second World War, when claims for plaques to men who had subsequently died of their wounds were accepted by many nations, Britain, Canada, Australia. I know examples for all of those. What did people do with the plaques when they got them? As the plaques arrived, the families receiving them felt great pride in what they had received. It was a unique artefact in British history in many ways, in how it commemorated everyone from the humblest private to the most senior soldier. And that most senior soldier was Lord Kitchener, who had gone down on HMS Hampshire in 1916. Kitchener being Secretary of State for War, head of Kitchener's army, the man who's been on the poster pointing at you to enlist for king and country. And he was actually, because he was the most senior soldier to die in the war, when some sample plaques were sent out, they were sent out with his name on. I've actually held two Kitchener plaques, one in each hand, and they're not copies, they're not fakes, they are originals sent out as examples. So it was a kind of a leveller, really, this the way this plaque was produced and issued. And I'm sure, as I've said, many families receiving it felt a great deal of pride. Others perhaps wondered, was that it? Was that the value of the sacrifice that their family had made? And sometimes you see that kind of cynicism begin to be reflected on some of the inscriptions on headstones across the battlefields of the Great War. Once they'd got the memorial plaques, people placed them on their mantelpiece, on their sideboard. Mothers took them to bed and kissed them each night. Others polished them with pride. Churches took them and created wider memorials with the plaques. Parents placed them on the family grave in churchyards. I've seen that many, many times over the years. You can wander into a churchyard and there's a memorial plaque on a family grave. And those who went on the pilgrimages, which we've discussed in previous podcasts, often took them with them to those battlefields and left them behind on the graves that they were visiting. Talking to some of the older War Graves Commission gardeners when I first used to go across to the battlefields, they mentioned that they could remember the bronze plaques being on graves. And I think sometime in the early 2000s, there was only one known example of that still surviving, where a plaque left by a family member was still on a grave on the battlefields. And whether that is still there, I really don't know. And I remember one of the first times I went to Gallipoli, there's a little museum in Krithia there, which has all kinds of objects recovered from the battlefield, including a memorial plaque that it looks like it's been in the sea. And it's to an officer from memory who was in the Dublin Fusiliers. So whether a family had gone there and almost kind of cast this plaque into the sea like a burial, and the plaque had eventually been washed up, I don't know. People used them, memorialised them, reacted to them, and engaged with them in all kinds of different ways. People bought frames for them. I'm looking at one in my office here, in my library, where a Fretworkers magazine produced a little template, and you could create a nice little bit of wood with a soldier blowing a bugle and place the plaque in that. There were metal plaques that you could buy, and stands and clips that you could attach them to the wall or put them on your sideboard or piano or whatever. There was a whole kind of industry built around the plaques. And I also know that people buried them. I had a friend who collected memorial plaques, and he first got interested in when he was a young man working with builders in London when they were clearing post-war blitz-damaged streets or streets that had been condemned. And very often, they'd have to clear everything, and very often in the gardens would be a tree, not a very old tree, but they'd have to pull that up as well. And he started to find these plaques amongst the roots. And that's a kind of a nod to an old English tradition of burying something to connect you to that person, almost as if the plaque are grave goods, if you like. And they've buried that, planted a tree on it, and then years later, when that site's been cleared, the plaque has been found. And I'm sure there are many, many other stories besides in the ways that people dealt with these plaques and what they did with them. For many, of course, these were precious objects to them, and the object took on a reverence, almost a holy status, to the next of kin of those soldiers who had died. And it led as well, sadly, to squabbles between mothers and wives. Who got what? A wife, direct next of kin, would receive a plaque. Why didn't the mother have one too? And there are examples of which more than one plaque were issued to a casualty, although that seems to be much rarer. And then eventually, of course, these plaques meaning so much in the way they were treated with reverence and placed in the high altar of so many houses across Britain and that wider empire. Eventually, of course, things changed. The parents and the direct family of the fallen began to fade away after the Second World War. That generation of parents who had lost boys in the Great War got old and they passed away. And more, I would guess, of these plaques ended up being thrown away or ended up in junk shops. And I guess for me, in the early 1980s, that's when my connection with them began, when I suddenly realised, living in Sussex and having places like Brighton that had regular junk markets and were full of antique and junk shops, I could wander down there and, even with my pocket money as a kid, could buy them. The average price of a memorial plaque in the early 1980s was as little as 50 pence. That was the value placed on the loss of a life in the Great War. It's quite sad to look back on that. For me, it was a sadness of seeing them abandoned and neglected and left in junk shops. I almost wanted to buy every one that I saw. And it made me feel as if these men somehow were forgotten. I think it's probably one of those things that drove me for many of those early years, to ensure somehow that those men would not be forgotten. And many of my contemporaries, of course, were doing the same. And I can remember the first memorial plaque that I ever bought. It was to Lancelot George Thomas Usher. I still have the plaque. He was from Poplar in London, served with the 4th Battalion Royal Fusiliers, and was killed in October 1914. He's commemorated on the Latouret Memorial. And it was rather strange that I bought a plaque to a man from Poplar, which is where my father had been born. So there was kind of a connection to a local area connected to my own family. And it made me realise, I remember holding it in my hand and thinking what it symbolised, and what an amazingly beautiful and touching object that it was. And I still feel like that to this day. For me, it's an honour to have these plaques. And I hate to think that so many of them are passed out of families, but many people, we have to accept, are just not interested in these things. And if I had to kind of pick a few plaques out and talk about them now, special ones to me, I'll give you a couple of examples. I've got one, and I'm looking at it now, to Ernest George Funnell. He was a lad from Eastbourne. He served with the 12th Battalion, the Royal Sussex Regiment, South Downs, and was killed at Rishborg on the 30th of June 1916. His body was never recovered. He's on the Lewes Memorial. It's a plaque burnt and twisted and buckled. It's been in a heavy, heavy, powerful fire and has been damaged by some kind of large impact or event. And that large impact and event and fire was caused by the Blitz on Eastbourne, where he came from in the Second World War, and the plaque was damaged, perhaps the only thing that was salvaged from the house where his parents had lived. So in holding this plaque, I'm holding a plaque that commemorates a man who died in the Great War, but was itself affected by the next Great War. That's a powerful object in its own right. And another one that I have that I've mentioned on this podcast before is a very, very polished plaque. Polished almost to oblivion. It's almost ghosted in the way that the features on it have been eroded away by the polishing, and where the little boxes with the name which commemorates this plaque commemorates Alexander Gaffin, the 17th Lancashire Fusiliers, a Jewish lad from Manchester. His name is almost gone. His mother has run her finger over that name time and time again, thinking of her boy. And I remember buying this from a dealer who almost gave it to me, and he said, why do you want a plaque in such condition like that? I've got loads of mint ones here you can have. But he missed the point. It's the symbolism of what this plaque, this polished plaque, this plaque where the name has almost been rubbed off by the fingers of his mother. How do you put a value on something like that? A very, very special object. So for me, and I'm sure many of you listening to this who perhaps have a few or perhaps collect them, these plaques are not just tactile objects that connect us to a real person, to a life lived and a sacrifice made. For me, they kind of represent these men, represent who they were, what they were, and what they sacrificed. I find them incredibly moving objects, amongst the most moving that I have in so many ways, which draw me to this subject. Through them, I'm drawn to this subject of the Great War. And it can never be about their monetary value. For me, the value of these objects is immeasurable because I like to have plaques that link me to special locations on the battlefields, units that I've researched, people who come from particular parts of the country, particularly in Sussex, that I know well and are special to me, or those that have walked the same fields and lanes as me and are buried in the cemeteries, those silent cities that I'm particularly drawn to time and time again. And when I sit here this evening, surrounded by some memorial plaques, holding one in my hand, for me, these names cast in bronze are one of the most powerful links that I have, perhaps that we all have, to those pathways of the old front line. You've been listening to Dispatches, part of the Old Frontline podcast, with me, military historian Paul Reed. If you've enjoyed this episode, please think about leaving a review on your favourite podcast platform, giving us a rating, and leaving a comment on the podcast website, oldfrontline.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter, and if you want to support the podcast, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/oldfrontline, or buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Thanks for listening, and see you again soon.